Welcome to the Speaking Podcast. You can find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com. We're also on BitChute and YouTube, the Speaking Podcast. Be sure to give us a 5-star rating, share with your friends. I also have the Awakening Podcast, the Learn Polish Podcast, and the Meditation Podcast, and all can be found on freedombroadcasters.com. Today, I'm looking forward to this conversation. Please welcome Steve Hafner.
Hello, Roy. Thank you for having me. It's good to see you.
So, first, I always like, you might let the audience know who's Steve.
Sure. Well, I'm an IT guy. I had a 30-year career in computer science. I was a systems analyst, a programmer, moved into management, and then I just quit and started my own business. And currently, I am a speaker. I call myself a decision performance expert. And that's one of the things we can talk about is I don't really consider speaking to be a profession or a job title. That's a delivery method of how you deliver your value to your customers. So I have done some morphing, some pivoting along the way with my business after I left my corporate career, and it's been quite a journey, and it's fun. But I like where I'm at now, even given with the pandemic having shut down the in-person speaking business, that has definitely been a challenge. But I'm based in Louisville.
Pivoting, Kentucky. I think, yeah, we need to pivot. I mean, we're all slapped with, all through life. What I'd like to know is, like, because normally IT analysts, they don't like to speak in public. So is it that when you got into the management side, you kind of realized, ooh, I've got a flair for this? Or what's your journey in speaking, even going back to the school age?
Yeah. Well, it is interesting. And I kind of have both sides of my brain working, I think. But, your first big decision that you make is when you're deciding what you're going to do with the rest of your life. And usually that's, at least here in the States, called it high school. Then you're going to decide what you're going to do, either go to work or go to college, and what you're going to study, what's going to be your major in college. So, at that point, and that's a tough decision for a young 17 or 18 year old to make, oh my gosh, what I have to choose already. But I thought, what are my passions? Well, I loved to write. I was into creative writing ever since I was old enough to pick up a pencil. I would write poems and songs and plays and short stories. And I loved that. So I thought, okay, well, that's a good indicator of something I might want to do, with my life. And I love to perform too. I was kind of a shy child, and performing, being in plays and on stage allowed me to kind of come out. I could get over that introversion when I had a script, and I had something to say. And so I loved performing. I loved writing. So what did I decide to major in? Computer science. And that was, I did like programming. I've always been into puzzles and games, and programming was kind of like that. And I took a course in high school in it, but my parents really thought, going into something in the performing arts, or that could be a tough row to hoe over the years, trying to find work and making a lot of money at it couldn't be difficult. But computer programming, that's becoming huge. So this was back in the very early 80s. And, there were tons of programming jobs. You can make a lot of money in computers, doing that. So they kind of were getting me to go in that direction a little bit. And I had agreed, so that's where I went. And that launched me on a 30-year career in IT, even though I had that creative side to me. And it does take creativity in the business world and programming. You've got inputs, you've got this data here, and your customer or, the stakeholder who is pushing your project is wanting to get to this output over here. So you have to be creative to get from point A to point B. But, over the years, and as I said, I did it for 30 years. So I was getting a little antsy, and I had moved from the programming side, the puzzle side, into management. Wasn't really loving that kind of work. And I was a business analyst for a big Fortune 500 company. And I had this inkling of an idea for a few years that I wanted to be a magician. Yeah, I know. I get that from a lot of people. So So, it, you know, magic was a hobby. I loved it when I was a kid, and I picked it back up when my kids were growing up. I thought they'd like to see some magic, and I really loved it. And I know, you know, locally there was one or two people that were making their living doing magic. And I'm like, well, this is something that could be doable. But, you know, I had that safety and security part of my brain saying, no, this is stupid. We're in the middle of a recession. This was 2011. And, you know, you've got a family to support. You're making good money in your career. You're going to throw it all away to do something silly like be a magician. Are you crazy? So, you know, you got that little voice inside of you. And so after a while, and I was liking my job less and less in the corporate world, that the voice that said, hey, you can do this. You could, you know, make a living with your passion. Plus magic, I realized, got my passions going again for writing and for performing, because you have to do both of those, you know, to perform as a magician. You have to write your own routines and patter. And so I loved it. You know, I did it as a hobby. I did it for charitable events. I did it for my kids' birthday parties, and I really loved it. And so I was, if you've ever had a big life decision to make and you're struggling with it, and it's not obvious what you should do, and you've got two sides, that's an uncomfortable situation, right? Roy, I'm sure you've been in that situation before. And in fact, it can be painful. And for me, it was very, very difficult. So one day I had driven to work, and I was sitting in my car. It was in a parking garage, and I wasn't getting out because I was like, I don't like this job. I'd love to just quit and be a magician. And what do I do? And I heard this song come on the radio. Never heard the song before. In fact, I've never heard it on the radio since. It was the one and only time I heard it on the radio. And some of the lyrics were amazing that they hit me right at that time. They said, there comes a time when you have to ask yourself, what am I doing? What have I done? Are you taking the rules that you've been given or breaking the rules with your own decisions? Isn't it time you tried? And that just really spoke to me, and it hit me like a wave of, I'm not even sure how to describe it, relief maybe. But I actually had tears when that hit me. Something as silly as hearing a song at just the right time, you know, but it was, I felt that this is exactly right. This is what I needed, that catalyst, that push. 10 minutes later, I was standing in my boss's office saying, boss, I quit. And he's like, what? You know, I thought you liked it here. You were doing great work. What's going on? Did you get a better offer? And I'm like, no, I'm quitting to become a magician. You know, I thought he would laugh me out of the office, but he didn't. And it was really nice because he smiled and he said, you know what? He said, I wish I had a passion that I could bolt from the corporate world with. He said, so, you know, we talked about it a bit. He was totally fine with it. You know, he wasn't mad at me or anything, and it was great. And I did have a lot of different reactions from colleagues and friends when I told them this is what I was going to do, you know, but that's what I did. So I launched a business of my own as a magician. I was doing, and I wanted to do shows for kids primarily. So I did fairs and festivals and schools. I had shows about eating healthy and about respect. So for schools, you have to tie it into an educational message. Preschools, birthday parties, everything. And I loved it. It was so much fun, but I wasn't getting the level of income that I wanted to get. So I started doing adult events, corporate events, and I performed as a mentalist. Have you ever heard that term, Roy? Mentalist.
I have, yeah. David, okay. Blaine and a few others that I'd be watching. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you know Darren Brown. So he's.
I do. I have his DVD. Yeah.
Oh yeah. He's really awesome. Yeah. So you could call him sort of a mentalist, and, you know, it's magic, but instead of focusing on the visual, it focuses on the mental. So it's like, I call it virtual mind reading and subliminal influence and things like that. And that adults react much better and stronger to magic of the mind, psychological illusion, than visual, because we don't really know exactly what the mind can do. You know, there's a lot of untapped potential. We're not exactly sure. And so, and that's one of the superpowers studies have shown people would love to have, mind reading, you know, the ability to know what other people are thinking. And if they go to a show and somebody's actually doing this, and, or it's looking like they're actually reading people's minds, you know, that blows them away. So I got into that. And so from the sales side, cause I've never been a natural salesman, you know, I was a techie in my corporate world. So now I have to be a salesman because I'm my own business. I'm a sole proprietor. And and it was a challenge for me because I'm, you know, like I said, I'm not a natural salesman. And I found that when I would reach out to groups that were having events, you know, as a magician, as a mentalist, and you know, I would see if they'd be interested. Most of them did not have entertainment. You know, the events didn't have entertainment, and those that did, they liked to stay with a band or maybe a comedian, but they didn't go for the variety stuff like magicians or jugglers or, you know, things that are a little more unusual. So it was a tough sell. You know, I did get some work in the corporate world, you know, doing magic mentalism shows, but it was tough. But what I realized, all those events, all those that didn't have entertainment, they did have education. But they wanted entertainment, but they couldn't call it that because they didn't have a cost center for entertainment. They didn't have a budget for entertainment, but they do for education. So they want people to come in and speak, but they want it to be entertaining. So it's like light bulb, you know. Brilliant. It's like, I need to be a speaker. Plus, so here's the interesting thing. I learned as a magician, I had to understand how to fool the human mind, right? Turns out it's not that hard to fool. And especially because it fools itself. We have this, you know, I call it the lizard brain. We have these internal subconscious distortions and preferences and biases and shortcuts that are constantly affecting how we think and make decisions. And they're illusions because they present reality, or they present information that is not in line with reality. So I thought, wow, you know, this helps me as a magician to know what other people's minds are doing that they don't even know that they're doing. But if I could teach people this, they could make better decisions. They could perform better in their jobs if they understood some of the subconscious illusions that are going on in there. So I thought this is a perfect topic to speak on. So I developed my speaking career. You know, this, I thought, here's what I'm going to speak on. Started doing it for free at small civic groups like Rotary clubs and Kiwanis and, you know, things like that, and built it up that way. And so I now call myself a decision performance expert. So what's a decision performance? You've probably never heard that term.
You've probably trademarked it, hopefully. Have you?
I haven't yet. Trademarking's kind of expensive. But, and somebody else has the URL for decision performance, you know, and they're not even using it. So
I'm not sure. You can always use .org or .net. That's what I do if the .com one is gone. And at the end of the day, once you're promoting yourself to a certain URL, people will go there.
Well, that's true. That's true. Yeah. So anyway, I came up with the term. I played around with different branding messages and phrases and things. And I love decision performance. And what it means is your decision performance is the level at which your decisions align with your goals and your values. So that's my succinct way of putting it. So I help people elevate, improve their decisions. And I don't ever try to tell people what decisions to make. I don't tell them what their goals and their values should be. I just help them try to recognize and get over the subconscious illusions so that they can align their decisions with their own goals and values. And so that's, you know, that's fun for me. And so I've had it, you know, here's what happened with COVID. And I guess with a lot of speakers, and all I did, Roy, was in-person events. That was my whole income stream. I didn't have alternate streams of income like a lot of other speakers do. At that point, it was just in person. I loved, you know, as I mentioned, I loved performing, loved getting on stage. And boom, you know, COVID shut it down. And, you know, for 2 weeks, I was walking around. I looked like one of the audience members in one of my magic shows, walking around just dumbfounded, like, what is going on? You know, it was a shock for me, and I basically kind of just shut down and threw my hands up and well this is over, you know, before I had tried to figure out, okay, now what do I do? I can't just sit here. I've got to do something. So one of the things that I did was decide, you know, as I mentioned earlier, speaking is not really what you do, it's a delivery method for you. So I had to reframe the way I thought about myself and the way that I presented myself. Instead of a speaker, I'm a decision performance expert. Speaking is just one of the methods that I use to get my message across. So I am currently working on developing these other alternate streams of income. I'm building up my credibility and my following, you know, as a decision performance expert, and you know, working on books. And I've got a course that I have that I've outlined that I'm working on. So I'm, you know, trying to build other things besides just speaking. You know, I still do some virtual events, and I've had some of my 2020 events postponed until 2021. Didn't help me as far as revenue in 2020 goes, though. You know, it's like, okay, that's great, but you know, so
you just have to adjust to what's going on, and like, yeah. Because like, going back to the magic, because you know, you mentioned you don't, which you get, that's why, you know, when we were connecting, I was looking forward to this, because my, you know, I got my son doing magic, and I think without them even realizing it, they're becoming a performer, and they're actually practicing public speaking skills that will actually benefit when they're getting older. And did you find that with your kids when you were doing the magic?
Oh yeah, yes, I did. It was great. It was, you know, I grew so much just getting into it, and, you know, speaking, just performing in front of people. One of my daughters took a public speaking class in high school, and for one of her projects, she had me teach her a trick so that she could then show and explain the trick to her class. So it wasn't like this. I didn't give away a well-kept magic secret or anything like that. You know, we have our magician's code, but that, you know, that helped her. She enjoyed performing it and then explaining it. So yeah, you know, and I hear from so many magicians who, when they started off, they were very shy, and magic was a way for them to connect with people. You know, there's something about it. And it's, I don't know if it's kind of mysterious, but there's something about magic, that feeling of astonishment, that sense of wonder that you can create through magic that connects people, you know? Yeah, so, exactly.
And the same with the video. So, yeah. Because, like, I was recording, you know, my son, and like, he's so comfortable. Like, he's 7, no, but he was 6 when we done most of this. He's so comfortable on the camera. You know, way more comfortable than most people. And it's all just and I think even when you're doing the magic, because like some of the stuff I'd be teaching them, a child is very brutally honest. So if they spot it or anything, so it's a good audience for you if you're practicing your skill with the kids, because like an adult might know what's going on, but they'll kind of, you know, they'll refrain from actually saying something, whereas a child will be just so blunt and say it as it is. And that's how you become better.
You're right. That is so true. I mean, if you can perform for, you know, kids, you can perform for anybody. I've heard of them. People refer to kids, they're like little drunk adults, because they have no inhibitions at all, you know, and they'll shout. I could be doing a kids show, and I could just pull out a deck of cards, and I'll have a kid yell, "I know this one," you know, or, you know, they're not shy. If they see, if you doing something secret and you, what we call flash, you know, you accidentally flash your secret move or something, they will tell their friends right then and there. They'll say, "He just put that behind his back," you know. So, exactly. So if you can, so that helps you develop a thick skin. It helps you get better. It helped me immensely. I mean, when I started as a speaker, I had been, you know, entertaining, doing magic for a number of years, and it was a pretty easy transition. You know, the speakers come from either from one or two sides, either as experts in a certain subject area and they decide to speak on it, or as entertainers who are used to being on stage and engaging and moving into speaking by coming up with what their topic will be. And they say that it's a lot easier to come from the entertainment side, that subject matter experts, especially depending on what the subject is, sometimes can have trouble being engaging. You know, it can be pretty dry and boring. And as a matter of fact, I was pretty dry and boring when I first started speaking, because I learned all this about the subconscious mind and how it works and how it affects us. And I wanted to give so much of that information to my audience that I just vomited information on them, is basically what I did in those early,
brain overload,
those
early days. They switched off.
Yeah. Exactly. You could get their eyes would glaze over, and you'd ask any questions at the end and they wouldn't know what to ask. They're just too, it was just too much information. And, you know, I have learned since then, being in the speaking business and being in the National Speakers Association, that, you know, you have to use your engagement techniques. You have to tell stories. You know, you have to use humor when you can. And I use magic. So I use magic and mentalism to highlight certain points of my topic and keep people engaged and make it memorable. And they have a lot of fun with that as well. So, yeah.
And
so
that with was the humor, because I seen some of your stuff, some of the videos that you've up, like you're able to use the humor. Not everybody can do that, but have you any tips or something to how people can incorporate humor in? Because some people, I think they try too hard and it kind of backfires. But I could say, like, I don't know, I it seems so natural with you when you were using the humor on the stage.
Well, thank you. You know, that's something else that it's taken a while to develop. And I'm not a comedian, you know, I'm not terribly funny. I just have a few moments, you know, that I have learned over time. Oh, this worked really well. You know, the audience loved this particular moment, so I'm going to keep using that one. And it's trying things. And that part of being a magician was I learned to have a thick skin and don't worry if a certain line or something doesn't go over that well, you know, from the audience, just learn from it and say, well, I need to change that up a little bit or take it out or do something different, you know? So don't be afraid to try things. You know, I found that telling jokes, sometimes that it works if the joke does relate to the particular thing that I'm talking about, but telling jokes isn't as effective as situational comedy, you know, or if it's part of a story, or if you can make it, you know, audiences like things that are connected to them. So if you can customize, if you can have callbacks to things that happened earlier with that audience or during the speaking engagement, then it doesn't even have to be that funny. If it's just a little humorous, they find it really funny because it's more connected to them, you know? So that's, yeah. So that's something
I do. The callbacks definitely, definitely work. And how do you actually prepare? Like when you're going to, say, different corporate events, you know, before these crazy times, like, was it kind of a 2 hour or how long was typically would you be actually doing the event for?
When I'm preparing for an event, you know, I will always have a conversation with the client beforehand and oftentimes have a questionnaire for them so I can get some more information about the audience, because you want to know your audience as much as possible beforehand. You know their demographics for one, know what their roles are, because sometimes you'll get, you know, it'll be an association of people that are, you know, small business owners of textile rentals or something like that. And so they all, you know, they're all similar. Sometimes it's a group of very diverse people, very diverse roles. So you want to get an idea of that, you know, what they're coming from. What are the big issues that they're dealing with in their industry, you know, or in their role of whatever it is, you know, is there something that's on their mind now? What problems are they having? Then I can maybe tie my decision performance topic, you know, more specifically to that. So I get as much information as I can. Sometimes
just on that, actually, because sure. When you're getting that, is that something with the person that's organizing you as the speaker that you're liaising to try to get a slot, or is it something that you have to try to do the kind of external research?
Usually it's the person that I've been in contact with. Usually they can answer those questions, but sometimes they're like, well, let me introduce you to this person over here because she's in a better position to answer these kind of questions. So it just depends, you know, but, you know, and I also find that it's good to know the gender makeup of the audience too, because, you know, if it's 90% men versus 90% women, that, you know, they respond differently to different types of presentation styles. So that's good to know too. Age is good to know. So I get as much information beforehand and try to incorporate at least some, and I'm getting better at this, at least some things that are specific to them in their industry into the presentation. And now that I'm doing virtual, I try to pull things, you know, when I do my PowerPoint slides, I try to pull things that come from maybe the association website, maybe their values page, because I talk a lot about values-based decision-making. So I'll pull their mission statement or their value statement, and, you know, we'll take a look at that. And so I do spend, you know, quite a bit of time trying to customize. And my topic is fairly broad. I mean, if you think decision-making, that's a pretty broad topic. So it's modular. There's lots of different subtopics within decision-making that I can pick and choose from when putting together a speech for a specific group, you know? So it does take some time, but it varies. I can't give you a specific amount of time that I spend preparing because it varies how much customization that I have to do and how new my program is. With COVID, I've come up with a couple of new programs, one on positive productivity, because positivity and productivity are two big issues that people are struggling with as they work more from home and trying to deal with the pandemic. And then team building and teamwork, I've developed a new one on that too. So if it's a fairly new program, I have to prepare more for it. And then most of my programs that I did prior to COVID were anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour. I could go up to an hour and a half. And I usually did keynotes and or breakout sessions. So, you know, sometimes they'd hire me to do both, or maybe just do a couple of different breakout sessions, you know, and those, of course, those are more educational, and they go usually a little deeper than the keynote. And the keynote tends to be more, I would put a little more magic into the keynote than I would into the breakout sessions, you know, more stories and more of the engagement factor. You know, it's a little bit more of a show than the breakout sessions, where you're getting into the nitty gritty and kind of workshopping some things with the individual members. So,
and when you're going through, like, say, if it's an hour and a half, are you having your trigger points from the slides, or do you have it all kind of, you rehearse so much that, you know, or do you have a little notepad with little bullet points? What's your kind of secret sauce?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it has changed now. And I feel like I've become a little bit lazy, because when you're doing virtual, you can have your notes right in front of you and you don't have to worry about remembering. But when I did keynotes, I was pretty well scripted, and I would, I was, you know, flexible enough to go off script and respond to the audience, but I was pretty well scripted, and I knew where I was going next. Now, I do prefer to have the presentation view of my PowerPoint and on a screen where I could see it. So I could see what the next slide was. That gave me a little bit more safety cushion, a little more confidence that I wasn't going to forget something or go off, you know, but I did. And at the beginning, I hated using technology. And in fact, my first programs that I developed, I could do with or without PowerPoint. So the PowerPoint slides were used for humor. You know, they backed up. I never had bullet points on the PowerPoint slide. You know, I didn't want to bore the audience and just read off of slide, that death by PowerPoint thing. You know, that's really boring really fast. But I would have funny pictures and things to kind of highlight what I was doing, but I could still do it without the PowerPoint presentation. I made sure, because I was never comfortable. You know, I come from a tech background, and yet I was never comfortable with having confidence that the tech was going to work, especially because, you know, you're, as a speaker, you're going somewhere different every time. And the level of competence with the tech side is different every place you go. You know, you may have a team, an AV team, and they know exactly what they're doing, and it's great. And then other times it might be somebody who's in a completely different role, and they're at, you know, and they just, oh yeah, I do the tech stuff for our group. And, you know, and then, you know, and something goes wrong, or they don't have the right cable to connect to their projector. You never know. So I wanted to be totally free to just do a talk and still have it engaging without a PowerPoint. I'm less so now, especially with virtual, because you want to provide as much a visual texture as you can. You know, enough variety instead of just being a talking head. So I use OBS, the software. It's similar, I guess, to vMix and Ecamm, and so that I can do, you know, picture in picture and other kind of effects where I can have things just besides just me talking. Anyway, so did that? No, I might have strayed from your original question.
No, perfect. No, it was great. And like, obviously, and I totally agree with you because it's happened to me as well, where two projectors actually failed. So, but it was in a Toastmaster, so it was like only 20 people or whatever, but I was able to still continue. But how long, if you were doing that, how long would you practice it? Would you be rehearsing a lot
for a live in-person event, or?
Yeah. Like, say, the keynote or something like that. If you didn't need the, you know, the PowerPoint, or if you realize this isn't going to work, just to have yourself kind of totally prepared, how would you be? Like, some people have it written out verbatim and then they kind of break it down. What's your kind of structure? Do you read it, you know?
Yeah,
200 times.
When I was doing a in-person events, and when I would have it you know, scripted, and I didn't need, and I could do it without a PowerPoint, I practiced a lot, you know, for it, days, weeks. You know, I wanted at least to have it down, or at least have my script down at least a couple of weeks beforehand, so that I could then spend those 2 weeks, you know, rehearsing it. But I wanted to have it down, you know, and I would tweak it at least a couple of weeks, and then, you know, I'd spend hours and hours with it, so I was comfortable. Now, I have, because I perform and I have some props that I use for my mentalism routines that I use, I have a box on stage with me, and on that box I have a printed outline of my talk. So if I freeze up, because when I was in theater in high school, and I did some community theater afterwards, because I told you I like to perform, there were a couple times where I went up on my lines, where I completely lost my spot.
I call it a brain fart.
Yes, exactly. A brain fart. So, and that's a scary situation. And so I want to have my outline so that if I just lost my place, I could just look over.
Brilliant.
Okay. That's where I am, you know, and I would still, you know, I think every speaker afterwards, you remember things. Oh, I forgot to tell this little story, or there's this great little joke that I have in here and I completely forgot that, you know, because you're focused on the structure and making sure the key points are hit, but it's easy to forget some of the little stuff that really makes it flow and makes it fun. And so that's easy to do. I think we all do that. The key for speakers, what I would say, and I tell my audiences this all the time, because, you know, I my focus is on getting better at decision-making, overcoming our screw-ups, the things that we subconsciously do that mess us up, but don't beat yourself up. You know, so I bring to light some of the ways we screw up. And as speakers, we make mistakes all the time, but it's important not to beat ourselves up. It's great to realize that you made a mistake, but look at it, say, okay, what did I learn from this? How can I keep this from happening again? You know, was it in my mind that triggered me to make this mistake? And if you can go through that process, then you're learning from it and you can put it away and not beat yourself up, because, you know, you're human. You've got a lizard brain, subconscious primitive brain that is messing with your decision making. So, you know, as speakers, we, you know, have a thick skin. And don't beat yourself up. I was reading just yesterday an interesting conversation with Daniel Kahneman. He's a psychologist, behavioral psychologist, won Nobel Prize for economy for back in the 80s. And he said, you know, you don't like to be wrong. He goes, but he likes to have been wrong, because what that means is you're less wrong now, because you realized you were wrong before. So that's going to make you less wrong now. So he loves to, if somebody points out that he was wrong, or if he's listening to a lecture from somebody and he learned something new and thinks, oh, so I was wrong about this particular point. Okay. And, you know, he has that flexibility, that open mindset, where he's happy that he found out that he was wrong, you know? So that's a great, great mindset to have.
Because
that keeps you from beating yourself up and like I said, learning what you can, but going forward and not being afraid to make mistakes.
And would you actually record, or would it be from the thing that would you look back on recordings of the event just to kind of, I know it's pain. I remember the very first time I done that, my first speech, it took me something like over a year to look at it because I thought it was cringeworthy. I thought it was so bad, but I had told myself that story. And when I looked at it, it was like, that wasn't that bad. You know, we tell ourselves the story and we hear it so often that we just stop believing it.
Right, right. That is one of the hardest things for me to do, though, is to watch video of myself. And so, and this is the double-edged sword. It's the hardest thing to do, but it's the best thing to do if you want to improve. If you want to get better, you have to watch yourself. And this goes down to how our subconscious mind fools us too. Our perception of ourselves is vastly different from other people's perception of ourselves. And by watching a video of yourself, you take that outsider's view to an extent. I mean, you're still you, but you can now see what other people can see to a degree. And that breaks a lot of the illusions that you have about what you look like, what you sound like, you know, how you come across to other people. So yes, it's very important to record, video record if possible, if not audio record, and listen to it and take tons of notes. You know, when I was in theater, after every rehearsal, the director would read off his notes that he had. Take notes on yourself. That's how you improved, you know? And that goes back again to not beating yourself up, because you watch that video and you're like, I can't believe how many times I said, or, you know, and it's okay. You just learn what you have to practice from. So, okay, well, that wasn't as good as I thought it was, but I'm going to get better, you know? And a lot of times you'll watch it and it's so funny how your perception after you give a speech or any kind of presentation, your perception can be so screwed up as to whether it was good or not, because sometimes you'll think, that didn't go very well. You know, the audience didn't respond very much. And then you watch on video, and like you said, that was a lot better than I thought, you know? Exactly. So you never know. And that's why the video helps so much.
No, exactly. And plus the feedback from the audience as well. Cause sometimes people, especially if people know you, you know, they'll come up and they'll say, oh, that was the best speech you've ever done. And you're kind of going, And by looking at it, then you're kind of seeing, you know, cause you can listen to the reactions as well from the audience. You go, all right, I touch with the stories you mentioned earlier. I know how important stories are. And you can go, okay, I see how this touched people. And that's why they connected so much.
Right, right. And it is tough to get honest feedback from people, because people are generally nice. And if they didn't like what you did or they found it boring, they're probably not going to tell you, you know. If you ask for a testimonial, usually they'll give you one and they'll say, oh, it was great, you know, we really enjoyed it. And that may not be what they really think. So, you know, it's kind of hard sometimes.
I know. Well, in the Toastmaster thing, you'll always have a lot of people, they'll give you a bit of feedback, but I always say, you're not going to hurt my ego. Be brutally honest. Give me the hard. And you know, and sometimes they'll tell you something like that. You go, oh, wasn't aware of that. And then you can just, as you said, the ahs and ums, you know, you become conscious of it. And by becoming conscious, you know, if it is something, whether it's good or bad, because sometimes they'll pick out something that was very good that you didn't even realize. And you know, you can just modify everything, reduce the bad stuff and increase the good stuff, and you become a better speaker.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's having a thick skin, because you can say, like you did, you know, give it to me, give me the truth, be brutal, you know? And then when they are, it's like, why are you so mean? You know, but then after you think about it, after you get over that hurt feelings and you think about it, you're like, oh, they're right. You know, I really do need to do that differently. So it's good stuff.
Before we started, I was talking about the gavel in the background, and that's something that I'm interested in. So you might explain about what the gavel is and the organization.
Sure. And it is, I am currently the president of the Kentucky chapter of the National Speakers Association. And we kind of have a tradition that we started in the chapter, that every year when the new board gets installed, the chapter gives a gavel to the outgoing president, gives a gavel to the incoming president. So it's just kind of a nice gesture there. And it has my, I don't know if you can see it. It has my name and it says NSA Kentucky president.
Oh yeah, I see. Yeah. Lovely. Yeah. No, that's very nice. Basically, for the people that aren't aware, the Speakers Association, you have to be kind of like a paid speaker to get in, or what's the actual joining criteria for that?
Well, there's a couple of different levels. So you can join at the candidate level, where anybody can join. If you're just starting your speaker business, or you want that to be part of your business and you want to learn more about speaking and how to do it well and how to grow and create a business, you can join at that level, but you're not then there's the other level is professional member. And I don't recall what exactly the numbers are, but you have to have given a certain number of paid talks, made a certain amount of money, and given it to a certain size audience in order to reach the professional level. Most chapters, including ours, has an academy every year. So people who are at the candidate level, it's like a class, and it's over, I think there's 10 different topics that are covered, and the National Speakers Association at the national level has this curriculum, but the chapter actually administers the course. And then that helps you learn all these different pieces that go into creating a speaking business, and helps drive you to be able to get to that level where you can become a professional member and a professional speaker. So yeah, it's a great organization. Toastmasters is great too. You know, I was a member of Toastmasters for quite a while. Actually, it was before I started my speaking career, because it was when I wanted to be a speaker, as make that transition from entertainment to speaking, and I'd heard good things about it. So it was great. You know, Toastmasters is a great way to hone your skills and get honest feedback.
Exactly. And I know that one of the things that you concentrate is kind of like on the mentality side of things. And, you know, a lot of people, I mean, you know, as you mentioned, you kind of pivoted, you saw, ooh, I'm in trouble here. And then you changed it and adjusted. There's some people that are struggling now. And I know you're good with the mentality. How can you get somebody, what's the best advice you can help with somebody? You know, they're looking to, it's raining today. You know, they just look at the dark clouds and, you know, just to see the sun shining.
Yeah. Well, it is a mindset thing. We have, go back to the lizard brain. We have a natural tendency to focus on the negative. In fact, there are studies of neuroscience that show they actually measure brain activity. And when we have negative thoughts, the brain lights up much more than if we have positive thoughts. So if you're thinking back on something embarrassing that happened or something bad that happened to you, your lizard brain likes that because it's always trying to avoid potential threats and keep you safe. So it's safer if it can focus on the negative than on the positive, right? So understanding that you have that natural inclination, and then, you know, there's all kinds of things. There's a whole discipline called positive psychology, which is fairly new, but it focuses on keeping you, you know, it uses mindfulness, so that, you know, meditation is part of that, but on being aware of what your mind is doing. And one of the techniques is to name your emotions. So if you are feeling, if you're struggling, name what the emotion is that you're feeling, you know, and write it down, and whether it is serving you or not at that time, you know. And it's not, and I talk about emotions a lot and how you often need to take them out of the decision-making process because they interfere. They're great catalysts. Emotions are great. And I'm not, you know, as humans, that's a delicious part of who we are is our emotions. But when they're a great catalyst to instigate change, but they're terrible in problem solving and decision making. You want to try to, you know, get the emotion out as much as possible. So you know, that's one of the things is recognizing and identifying your emotions. Gratitude, you know, this gets talked about over and over again, how gratitude can get you into a positive frame of mind. Tony Robbins and other people talk about having an attitude of gratitude and having, you know, a certain time block in the morning when you wake up where you are going to spend 20 minutes thinking of what you're grateful for and starting your day that way. And you know, that helps take you out of the victim mentality, even when things are going bad. You know, like for me, I was in a victim mentality when COVID hit and shut down my business. It's like, okay, well, wait a minute. I'm in pretty good shape here. You know, I'm, you know, there, if you look at where I am, you know, compared to most of the people in the world is, you know, in terms of comfort, you know, financial situation, you know, I'm doing much better. And I have a family, you know, that I love and that loves me, and I've got connections, and I've got a lot of good things, a lot of blessings that I can think about. So, so that, you know, help me during this tough time.
No, brilliant. Yeah. And like, I think the gratitude, cause I mean, I meditate every day, and I think it's the gratitude, cause you know, whether it's your, you know, your, my son, you know, just give me a cuddle or just having breakfast with him or just everything you're thinking of it. Because unfortunately, a lot of the time people wake up and they're just thinking, oh no, I must do this. I must do. And it's like, no, just set yourself up. Think of the positive, you know, think of all the nice things and, you know, what you think about, what you attract, you know, and it just, it becomes sweet in how you do it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And one thing, my positive productivity program I talk about is to focus on the things that will bring you a deeper level of meaning and fulfillment, because it's that movement towards a higher goal, you know, to a better place. Like I'm in this state now, I'm setting a goal because I want to be here. It's that movement that actually makes you happy, you know, and more than short-term bursts of happiness and gratification. And those are fine too, but you want to, what gives you the real happiness is feeling like you're moving to something better, you know, that you're becoming better, that you're improving in some way, elevating your state, you know, in whatever way that it is, you know, becoming a better person or helping more people or whatever. But as long as you feel like you're moving in the right direction, that brings happiness.
Absolutely. And like I've seen, you know, because you've got pictures of your different clients, you've got an impressive client list, you know, the PMI, because like I call it, I'm a pimp, you know, the PMP from 1999, because there seems to be, everybody now seems to be posting that. It seems to be getting a bit easier, I think. But and then you have Amazon. So one, you know, people aspire to get a client like that. How did that come from just doing all these kind of Rotary clubs and just building it? Or, you know, because a lot of people want to get into the door to the bigger audiences, like them big companies.
Right. Right. And we, yeah. And, you know, and with Amazon and it looks like, wow, he spoke to Amazon. He spoke to thousands and thousands of people, but I spoke to, or actually I did magic. It was performance that I did for Amazon. And it was a local, I was like 45 minutes away from here, a big distribution center that they had, and they were having an event for all the employees there. And they hired me to come out and entertain all the employees there. So that's how Amazon had hired me. But I will tell you, you know, when we talk about getting clients, because I do have some pretty big name clients, you know, but that doesn't mean that I spoke or presented to their national headquarters or international headquarters or anything.
Even if it's one guy at home, it's still the company that are paying you, so it doesn't matter.
Right, right. You know, and I'm, you know, I'm totally honest about who I put up there. They have all been clients of mine. That, you know, that's absolutely true. It's a lot of work. The prospecting, the lead generation, and all that is a lot of work. And it takes a lot of emailing and calling and getting in touch with people and having a thick skin and taking rejection and not taking it personally. That at first, that was tough for me. When I first started my own business and I would reach out to people and they weren't interested or they wouldn't return phone calls or emails, I'm like, why? You know, and I took it personally. But after a while, it's like, okay, people are busy, you know, or they may see this isn't a good fit, or, you know, people are a lot more sensitive to salesy calls, salesy outreach, you know, so they don't want to be bothered because with, you know, with the internet and email and everything, they're just getting bombarded all the time. So, but you know, you have to keep at it. You have to reach out with something. My recommendation when on your outreach, and you do, especially early on, you have to do outreach until you build your credibility and you have people start more inbound leads coming to you. When you are doing your outreach, don't spam, don't do bulk emails. Make each one customized at least a little bit. I was listening to a Zoom conference with some association executives, and that's what they said. They said, you know, if you send me an email out of the blue, and it could have been to anybody, and that's not specific to me, I'm deleting it, you know. But if you show that you know who I am, maybe when my event is or where it is, or you can speak to something that shows that you're speaking to me and not just a big group, then they're going to pay attention to it at least a little bit and see if it's something that's interesting to them. So,
yeah, very good. Very interesting. And I mean, anytime I'm doing anything like that, where you're making calls and just trying to, whether it's getting investors, I always have a, you know, the more no's I get, the closer I get to a yes. I try to, you know, go on the positivity side, and, you know, and it might take you maybe 100 the first time, then you get it down to 50, then 25. And, you know, then you go, okay, I need to make X amount of calls before I get approximate, you know, so many gigs for the month or for the year or whatever.
Right. And you know, if you don't like doing the outreach that much, qualify your prospects better then, and you won't have to contact so many. Because I know some people that will just, they'll get a list and, you know, contact hundreds and hundreds. But if you qualify first, if you go through the list and say, and see ones that look like they would be a better fit for you, you know, then you don't have to do quite so much outreach. It takes a little bit more time on the front end, but you'll have a higher closing rate.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. That's very good. And is there organizations that will do that for you? Is there companies that will actually do the dirty work, let's say, you know? I mean, you're losing the connectivity as well by doing that, you know, which can.
Yeah. I have always done it myself. Other speakers will hire somebody to do it, like a VA, a virtual assistant, but they, you know, they have to understand your business pretty well. They have to understand your value, and they have to understand what types of clients are a good fit for you, you know, in order for them to be able to do that qualification. You know, they could do it to a degree. Sometimes you qualify, like I spoke mostly to associations, sometimes to corporate groups, like you mentioned, Amazon and 3M, but it's mostly associations. And, I'm trying to remember where I was going with that. Do you remember what that point was?
It was
talking about qualifying yeah, the association. Yeah, yeah. So sometimes an association, there's all sizes of associations, and you might have a small one that doesn't have money to pay speakers. Well, you don't want to spend a lot of time trying to get in touch with them if they're not going to pay speakers and it's your business. So, you know, qualifying them based on things like that, then that's not that difficult to get a VA to be able to do for you.
And like when you are speaking at different, I mean, it's different if it's an open event that's kind of just open to everybody. You can maybe do a bit of a pitch or just be around the room later with potentials of getting other clients. But when it's for, say, like a corporate client, you can't really do that. And you're, is there times that you would actually get additional clients from a corporate event, or everybody is working for the Amazon, or everyone is working for the PMP or whoever?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, from associations, yes. From my corporate ones, not really. Yeah. And, you know, but at least 90% of my clients were associations, or are associations over corporate. I'm trying to break in more into the corporate, but you know, yeah, some associations, especially if they are associations of leaders, and so they all have their own companies, their own businesses where they have staff, and they think that, you know, what I talk about would be valuable to their staff, then that's a great group for me to get in front of. And it also, you know, kind of speaks to whether you should do free gigs or not. You know, if this is your business, you know, doing presentations, should you ever do them free? Some people say the only thing you get out of doing a free gig is more free gigs, but that's not true. That's absolutely not true. I mean, I've got several instances where I could point to and say, I did this free one. This person got in touch with me and I got a paid gig from them. You know, it's because it's who the audience is. Is it an audience of potential buyers? Then heck yeah. Then, you know, I would do that for free if necessary. Try to get paid, but you know, if necessary, I would do it for free because it's good, you know, good exposure. And the main thing is getting in front of as many potential buyers as possible, because that's how you sell, especially when I was doing entertainment, but even so as a speaker, getting in front, letting them see what you do is how they're going to make that connection and trust you. You know, they have to trust you and like you. What is it they say? Know, like, and trust. You know, that's who a buyer is, somebody who knows, likes, and trusts you. And the way for them to do that is to get to see you. And, you know, you can create video, but if they can see you live doing it, that helps a lot.
Excellent. Listen, Steve, I love all the different things you've done. I know you've got an ebook and everything. How can people get in contact with you?
Yeah. Well, my website is ground zero for getting in touch with me, stevehafner.com. And that's Stevehafner. And I have an ebook. It's 7 strategies for making great decisions. You can get that for free. And a newsletter called Cognizance. So I talk about, it comes out once a week. It's a quick read and it links to my blog, and I have a couple of fun things in there as well. And, you know, you learn about, things that interfere with our decision-making and just how to be better decision makers, how to be more productive, how to be more creative. So it's really fun for me. And I think it gives people a lot of value. And it's, like I said, it's a quick read. And, subscribe. If you don't like it, of course you can unsubscribe, but I think it's
something. I'm sure they'll love it, Steve.
So, and I'm working, have a couple books in the work that I hope to get published this year. And, you know, it's all part of building that foundation, building that credibility as a thought leader.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah, sure. Let me know when they're released and I let the audience know that they've been done. And I put all the links on the description of the podcast so people can actually find you. So
great.
It's been wonderful, Steve. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Roy. I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
So that's all for the Speaking Podcast. You can find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com. We're on BitChute, we're on YouTube. And until next week, take care.